Good evening. I'd like to call the Health Commission to order. This is our Monday, November 9th meeting. Welcome. I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes or any corrections or additions.
Move to approve.
I'll second.
Any dissent? They're good to go. Thank you, Jean. Next is public comment. Persons desiring to speak on issues other than scheduled items that are within the scope of the interest of the Health Commission, please come forward. Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the Commission. Marie. No. Are you Marie? Are you Mary Ellen?
I'm Marie.
Okay. You're...
Oh, I'm up?
You're up.
Sorry. I was waiting for somebody else to show.
No, Marie, you're
Maybe
it tonight.
Maybe I can interview.
Is Joyce Ellen coming as well?
It's a good thing this is an understanding and informal group. I apologize.
I'm Marie Brinkmeyer, and I am the Director of Senior Volunteer Services, RSVP, here in San Luis. And I'm coming back to you tonight. I thank you certainly for the opportunity you gave to Joyce Ellen Lippman and me a couple weeks ago to explain to you what we're trying to accomplish with our Good Neighbor program. And so what you have in your hands now is our update and, again, our request for consideration for your endorsement of this program. We've made some progress. We had a second meeting with Ashley Payne, who is the director of the Community Partners in Caring in Lompoc and Santa Maria area, and her board has expressed an interest in knowing more about what it is we want to do, or what we plan to do, and then they want to be sure, though, that we have the resources that would be needed in order to bring this to fruition. So what we did then was to develop a budget, an annual budget for the year, which comes, as you'll see, to $27,500, which we feel is a fairly modest sum, considering what we hope to accomplish with that money. And so at any rate, what we're asking for again then is your endorsement of this program with a recommendation that I gave them. sorry about that. with your recommendation that it go forward and be considered for some grant funding, because we will need that to support the effort. Do you have any questions that I might answer about this?
I have one, Marie. Are you familiar with the grant cycles for the county?
Yes, I know it's coming up here.
Okay.
In January.
Huh? Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
Somebody want to make a motion?
I don't know. Joyce may have something she'd like to add. Yes, Pam.
I was just going to make a motion.
Okay.
I think that we should prepare a letter for the Board of Supervisors offering our support and also indicating that we are looking for some financial backing in order to get the project off the ground and to get it up and running, and because I feel it's a very beneficial program for the community.
I'll second it.
Thank you.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed?
On behalf of all those that will benefit, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming back again. We'll make sure to copy you on the letter. Okay, looks like Rich Little, Bob Dowell. Who else is coming up? Brenda? Please do. You will need that if we're going to televise it. Okay. Okay.
My name is Richard.
It is. Okay. All right. I'm Richard Little, the Deputy Commissioner for the County Agriculture Department here. One of my responsibilities is to oversee eradication programs such as the one that we're presently having going on in Los Osos. I would like to introduce Dr. Bob Dowell, who is the director for the state project on the light brown apple moth, who's overseeing all these projects in the state. And I'll turn it over to him now.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come down and address this body. I have with us Dr. Anna Phan, Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. Anna, if you would please tell them your title, I'll botch it every time.
Yes, I'm Anna Phan. I'm a toxicologist with the California EPA. Specifically, our office is Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. I'm a branch chief, which is pesticide and environmental toxicology branch. We do risk assessments. We do not regulate or register pesticides, mainly assessment of chemicals in the environment, including pesticides.
We're here tonight to bring you an update of a eradication program we're about to start in your county. The eradication program is aimed at an exotic pest called the light brown apple moth. This insect is native to Australia and New Zealand. It was discovered in California in late 2006 in the Berkeley area by Dr. Jerry Powell, a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley, and a black light in his backyard. Subsequently, we have established a statewide detection program for this insect. We have found it in about 12 counties, running from Monterey to Sonoma, going north-south, out through Alameda, Contra Costa, Santa Clara counties, with outlier infestations in Yolo County in Davis, Manteca, and Tracy in San Joaquin County, and right now two spots in your county, Los Osos and the Arroyo Grande area. In Arroyo Grande, we have enough moths and immature stages to guarantee that the insect is breeding, and we are going to start an eradication program aimed at this particular exotic pest. The tool we'll be using is mating disruption. Moths communicate to males and female moths by putting a scent into the air. The female moth puts this out. The male moth smells it with his antennae and flies to find the female to mate. This material is called a pheromone. Almost all moths use it. So if you go out at night and look at all the moths in your back window, in your back porch next to your light, every one of those moths is using a pheromone to communicate. So you're awash in a sea of pheromones. The moths can smell them. The moths react to them. We don't. What we plan to do is to deploy something called a twist tie. I'm going to hand out a twist tie. You can take a look at it. It's a piece of wire wrapped with plastic. Inside the plastic is about 0.2 milliliter of the pheromone. The pheromone will slowly evaporate through the plastic and basically saturates the area with the pheromone so the moths can't orient. I guess the best way to describe it is this. If you go into a house you've never been in and someone's cooking chocolate chip cookies, you can go smell the air and you can tell where the kitchen is. You can follow the scent. You just go where the scent keeps getting stronger and stronger and stronger till you find the kitchen. The moths do essentially the same thing. What we're going to do is to make every place smell the same, essentially, to the moth. So no matter which way the male moth turns, it won't be able to find a stronger scent or gradient to follow. This has been used very successfully in California by a number of growers over the last few decades in crops like avocados, almonds, stone fruit, palm fruit, for things like coddling moth and oriental fruit moth. It's used on artichokes for the plume moth. It's a widely used technology that we're adapting for this particular program. What we will do is to place a twist tie on a carrier that will be stuck on trees or in shrubs. Here's the carrier. It's all made of plastic. If it's on trees and they're tall enough, we'll put these twist ties and units out of reach. If they're on smaller trees or shrubs and we don't have larger ones available, we'll try and put them inside so they're not particularly obvious. These will be out for about 150 days, at which point we will retrieve all of them and replace them. At the end of the program, after two life cycles of the insect of treatment, if we've caught no moths, we'll retrieve all the twist ties. We will then trap for one more life cycle, and if we catch no further moths, we'll declare the population eradicated. It's a technology we have used in about a dozen counties thus far in California. We've had a number of successes, provided two things happen. One, we can get all the moths in the entire area that moths will be in treated. And two, there's not a lot of movement of moths from the outside into the area. In Los Osos, we believe we've got the population delimited. We have a pretty good idea where it is. And this is an isolated infestation, so there's not a lot of emigration of wild moths, weather moths, into the population. The treatment area is a 200-meter radius around each property at which a light brown apple moth has been trapped. This material is very effective within that 200-meter radius and not much outside it. In some areas, we've caught moths, 50 to 100 feet outside the treatment zone. We then expand the treatment zone to encompass the new moth. So it's a very limited application of this particular technology. Notification. We have already notified every residence inside the 200-meter radius of what we're going to be doing. This was done door-to-door with a notice in both English and Spanish. We've already held a public information open house for all the citizens. I believe it's the Los Osos Community Center. Los Osos Community Center, thank you. South Bay Community Center. Before we go in to deploy the twist ties, there'll be another notice put on every resident's door telling them we're coming. We'll give the date. We ask for their cooperation. We ask that they put the dogs in and leave the gates open because we'll be putting these in front yards and backyards. Before we replace the twist ties, we'll do the same thing with a public notice. And before we remove the twist ties, we'll do it again. And all these notices are done door-to-door by hand in both English and Spanish. On the notice, it gives information of what we're doing, a little background, and it will give two phone numbers, two hotlines, one of them for information about the program and what we're doing, and one if you have health concerns. And they'll be able to make phone calls and talk to people about either operational considerations, problems they've got, they're not going to be home that day, can they reschedule, all these things. If they have health concerns or health questions, they'll be able to talk to people who are trained to deal with those kinds of issues. Let's see, what else do I need to cover? The pheromone is fairly specific to light brown apple moth. It affects about five other species of moths. These are all related insects. They include the fruit tree leaf roller, the orange tortrix, omnivorous leaf roller. These are all pestiferous moths that are fairly widespread in California. They will be affected within the 200-meter radius. Once the twist ties are removed, they will simply reinvade that area from the outside. And basically, fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon one's point of view, you won't notice any difference in the population of those moths. It does not affect any other animal. It does not affect any vertebrates. It does not affect people. It does not affect fish. It doesn't affect dogs, cats, birds. It doesn't affect people. So it's a fairly specific technology to the light brown apple moth. It does not kill the light brown apple moth. The moths are simply confused, and we hope they die without mating. So the material is essentially non-toxic. That's a quick overview. I'm here to answer any questions you might have. Dr. Fan can answer any questions on the toxicology, the human risk assessment. Rich?
Do you want to cover the difference maybe between a lure and a pesticide?
Okay, something has come up. There are some questions about whether or not this material is a pesticide. And it's a quirk of the law. It is, in fact, considered to be a pesticide. If I take this pheromone and put it in a trap, in a statewide trapping program, it's a lure. By law, however, as soon as I use this material to control the light brown apple moth population, it becomes a pesticide. So it's one of the quirks. In reality, following the law, if you are hosing down your roses to knock off the aphids, technically that is a pesticide, because you're using that material to control a population. So although the material has virtually no toxicity, it is considered to be a pesticide. And this is, in fact, by law, a pesticide application. Anything else? That's a quick overview. You've got the twist tie. You've got a chance to look at what it looks like. Let me hand out some cards if you have questions. I can be contacted in Sacramento, either by phone or email. I would recommend email. I'm falling behind on my phone messages. We'll be happy to answer any questions you have. We're working very closely with your county agricultural commissioner. This is my third trip. I'll have one more down here. We've met with, as I say, the citizens at an open house. We've met with three of the five board of supervisor members. I'll be meeting with the other two the next week or so. If you have any need for any of us to be down here at meetings, we'll be delighted to come down and talk and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your report very much. Where else has this worked in California?
We've eradicated populations of light brown apple moth in Dublin, in site in Marin. We just finished up a site in Carpinteria. We finished up Sherman Oaks in Los Angeles County. We've had some luck in a couple of other counties, Napa. So we've successfully used it in Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Alameda, Napa. My brain is going dead on where all these places are. Counties, at least four or five counties.
What is your measurement for success?
Our measurement for success is that we will have three successive life cycles of trapping of the insect inside the treatment area with no moths detected. Two of those life cycles will be with the pheromone deployed, which we admit does interfere with the traps. The third life cycle is after we remove all the twist ties, and we then trap for a third life cycle with intensive trapping with no moths detected. This is essentially an international standard of success for an insect eradication program.
So this is international, you're saying, too?
This is pretty much the international standard, yes.
Yeah, Thank you very much.
Here, too.
Commissioner Green?
Hi, thank you for the presentation. Now, there are other ways of spreading the pheromone out. I think I read somewhere where you could fly over and drop it. These other places where you had success, were they all with the ties, or were there other ways of applying it?
Okay, there are essentially functionally four or five ways we can disperse the pheromone. We could apply it by the air as a droplet with a microencapsulated product. We did that in Monterey and Santa Cruz. We could fly it on with a material that is a wax-based material. We have not used that. We could fly it on with a biodegradable flake. We could also apply those same kind of tools from the ground. We have not done any of those other ones from the ground, and the successes we've had have been exclusively using the twist ties. At this point in time, we have no plans to deploy any other tool in the Los Osos area except twist ties.
Why is that? Why did you choose twist ties?
We chose twist ties because it's a small, isolated area. It's two or three 200-meter radii. About three 200-meter radii. We can do that quickly and effectively from the ground. Mm-hmm. It's way too small for aerial. And this tool has proven efficient and effective. There is an environmental assessment that's been produced by the USDA with a finding of no significant impact that's available on their website specific for Los Osos, which gives up more background information. But for small isolated infestations like this, the deployment of twist ties is effective. It's both operationally effective and in the end effective. It minimizes any problems we might have otherwise. And again, it's just something we've been able to do and use effectively.
On a toxicological basis, is there an LD50 to this thing? Is there some concentration that we know is harmful to humans?
There are LD50 data. We have Our toxicologists have looked at the data on toxicology and exposure and did a risk assessment and a report. Overall, is let me briefly describe our approach. In our office, our programs are responsible for setting permissible limits for chemicals in the environment, such as air and drinking water. These become the numbers and assessments that are used by Airborne and the Health Department to set state regulatory numbers. So we use the same methodology and approach to assess TRISTI and the ingredients contained therein. And specifically, regarding your question on LD50s, an LD50 is a value used to in a test population, like any population of 10 mice like that, that would kill 50% of that test population. For setting for the standard procedure, people would test, or as prescribed by US EPA, people would test up to a maximum value, like for in terms of oral ingestion, 2 milligram per kilogram for the entire animal. So if it is tested up to that amount and we did not see any toxicity, that means we don't have acute toxicity concern. For both the inhalation route and oral route tested in animals, the chemical was tested up to the maximum and we didn't see any acute toxicity.
So you have no fear then that if it falls off a tree and someone picks it up and starts sucking on it, it's not going to run into any problems?
We don't anticipate any problem in terms of the rate of exposure, the application, the amount that was used, and how exposure might occur.
Okay.
So that is, we have described in some way in the document.
Now, will the people where you put these ties in the specific yards, they'll know that they're in there and they'll know where they are?
They'll know they're in there. I cannot guarantee they'll know precisely where all of them are. As I say, we'll try as much as possible to put them out of reach. We don't to hang them at the end of trees and end of branches where they're widely visible for obvious reasons. But they'll know they're there. I will emphasize again, we will retrieve all of them. We have retrieved 100% of the twist ties to date. We count them going out and we count them coming back.
Okay, good.
We want them out of the environment, both for pollution reasons, not polite to leave them out there. And if we're going to trap after we're done, these will interfere with the trap. We want to make sure that if we say there's no moths there, there's no moths there. So we have retrieved 100% of the twist ties.
Okay. And one last question. How long is their life cycle, one life cycle?
Of the moth?
Yeah.
You're going to get about, we're estimating a little over 3 life cycles a year down here in Los Osos. That's using weather data from Morro Bay. We'll put a temperature recording device in the treatment area, and we'll update that periodically. But we're looking to have the twist ties out for probably the better part of 7 to 8 months.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Craven? Okay. Anybody else? Commissioner Honoro?
Yes, thanks for coming out. First, I have one question for the local ag people and then one for you. I'm wondering, I know this is not aerial spraying, but just for reference, if that were proposed on some other situation, does your department still have the pesticide registry of the people who signed up that they're extra sensitive to pesticides?
Yes, we do. I'd like to elaborate on the notification process a little bit. About 15 years ago, when we had the Gasoline Sharpshooter program, we in the county developed a chemical sensitivity registry. And that was the county's responsibility. The state and the feds were not involved with that in any way. What we did was we basically gave people in the community the option of a notification from us directly if any government treatment program was going to occur in their community. What we've done in this case is we've taken that list and we've gone through it to find out who lives in the Los Osos area. And I sent them a letter several weeks ago notifying them of this project. So far, I have not received any replies from any of them, and 4 of them come back as undelivered. So.
Very good, thank you. And then for you, do you anticipate getting all the traps out in one day? Do you have enough people working on it? And that's a small enough area. You'll cover your area in a day or more?
My understanding is it'll probably take a couple days. As I say, we'll be putting notices out starting Monday, and we'll be deploying the twist ties later next week. My estimate at this point from my field staff is it'll take a couple days.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And again, these won't be a trap. These will just be the twist tie on the carrier, as you saw, which will be hung in trees. And
oh, yes. Yeah. Understand.
Any other questions before I start? Thank you. As many times as we've discussed pesticides on this body, seems like the Ag Commissioner's Office has done their homework. But I do have a concern. You're somewhat meshing South County, Arroyo Grande, and Los Osos, but yet when you talk about the twist ties, are you mainly talking about Los Osos? Are you done with Los Osos? Are you now going to South County, Arroyo Grande area with the twist ties? Could you differentiate that?
At this point, we're only going to be deploying the twist ties in Los Osos. There are two moths that have been trapped in Arroyo Grande. That is the trigger for an eradication program and a quarantine is two moths within 3 miles of each other in one life cycle. We believe that this is evidence that there is a reasonable probability there's a breeding population there. There's no guarantee there is. Our plan right now in Arroyo Grande is, quite frankly, to sit and take a look and see if we get a third moth. If we do not get a third moth, we'll assume that these were two carrions. There was no population breeding there. And at the end of three life cycles of negative trapping, if no other moths are found, we'll go home and we won't do anything in Arroyo Grande.
And if you do find a third moth?
We will go in and deploy the twist ties exactly like we're planning to do here.
How many people attended the South County, South Bay Community Center meeting?
There were six that showed up.
Six? Okay. Were they? Did they happen to be on your list?
We met with each of them individually.
Okay.
You know, tried to find out what their concerns were.
If there's any adverse reaction in the community, what would that be, do you think?
I'm going to smile and give that to Dr. Phan.
Thank you.
First of all, we do not expect to have adverse reactions. However, just in case, like you said, I mentioned that in terms of acute toxicity, we do not see any acute effects of toxicity from testing in animals. There is one particular endpoint, and that was skin irritation that was observed in animals under very exaggerated testing condition. And that condition was concentrated material, extended time of leaving the material on the skin, shave back of the animal, and also occlusion when there is a pad applied to the top so that the chemical won't evaporate or disperse or diffuse in any way. Under that exaggerated condition, the animal shows skin irritation. But in terms of human effects, is looking at the data itself, the concentration, the exposure that might be experienced, we do not expect that to happen. And if people, for any reason, they feel that there is an adverse effect they experience after any applications, they are encouraged to call the Poison Control Center, just in case.
And to tag on to that, because animals and children are very curious and
right.
love to put things in their mouths, what happens, say, like if a dog chewed on one of the ties or a child started sucking on a tie?
We did take that into consideration. In our assessment, we make a certain assumption in terms of a child. First of all, the session does include individuals of all ages, adults and children. Secondly, specifically for the children, we did make an assumption in terms of if that happens, what may be a potential concern. Our quantitative assessment showed that there shouldn't be any anticipated health effects, even with that assumption.
Commissioner Greena?
A couple more questions. So is this an organophosphate?
No.
No, this is not.
It is not. Okay.
This is a straight-chain lepidopteran pheromone. Isn't that a great word? Basically, it's carbon and hydrogen atoms stuck together. It's not an organophosphate.
Okay.
It does not have any toxicity at all.
Okay. And can you speak to what would occur if this were to get out of control? How would it would affect our agriculture here?
Light brown apple moth is a internationally recognized pest. At this point in time, the USDA has quarantined parts of California to prevent its spread throughout the rest of the United States. There are standing quarantines from Canada, Mexico, and Chile. We've had inquiries from China and a couple of other countries. If light brown apple moth is allowed to spread throughout California, the quarantine will spread, and growers will apply pesticides of any number of types, whether it's pheromone, whether it's Bacillus thuringiensis, whether it's spinosad, whether it's pyrethroids, to, one, prevent damage to their crops, and two, to meet the quarantine regulations. We also foresee that this insect eats hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of plants, both agricultural and ornamental, that there'll be damage to plants in the urban environment. And based on University of California studies on people's pesticide use, we expect that a small but not insignificant percentage of homeowners up and down California will apply pesticides to protect their plants. So we look at pesticide use as in both the urban and agricultural setting as a direct result of this insect spreading. We also look at economic losses, both in terms of agriculture and direct losses to the crop, losses from the pesticide application, and losses from quarantines. So you'll see monetary losses and you'll see increased pesticide use, and that's what we're projecting. That information in more detail is contained in an environmental impact report that was issued a number of months ago by the department.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to personalize that statement a little bit more. Right now, we have approximately 100 agricultural operations that have to operate their business under what's called a compliance agreement because of this apple moth. That means they have restrictions in regards to where they can ship their product because there are other countries that say you have to do these regulations in order for them to ship. And if you think about it also, we need to be reminded that the agriculture industry in this county is worth about $606 million. So it definitely has a potential effect if they can't ship.
Any other questions? Ann, I see you out in the audience. Did you want to say anything this evening?
I know far more than I do. I'm just here if you had any questions regarding anything that might.
Well, thank you all for coming. I don't think there's any action required on our part, but we will call you back if we need to.
Please don't hesitate. If all of you got cards, don't hesitate to contact us. We'll be delighted to answer any questions you have, and if we need to, we'll be delighted to come back. And again, I will emphasize we're working extremely closely with your county agricultural commissioner to make sure that the people are notified of what we're doing. They have ways of getting information and they have ways of contacting us on what's going on. And we appreciate your time and interest. Thank you very much and have a good evening.
And Richard, would you come back and let us know how it turned out?
If the members are interested afterwards, I have some samples that we use for training purposes of what the moth looks like. Just in case you're wondering.
Oh, you can pass that around.
You have to pass them down now.
Okay.
I will be brief and just touch on our H1N1 efforts and maybe tell you a little bit about the current status of our ongoing negotiations, too strong a term, our efforts with CHC to try and figure out how best to deal with some of the loose ends that existed in our contract so far for this year. So I thought maybe Ann was here to help me out on the H1N1 thing, but she's gone. the emphasis this week is on school-based, school-located mass vaccination clinics. Saw Michelle Shoresman on the news this afternoon, did a good job explaining that we don't really know how many kids to expect at any of the schools that we're doing because the schools get the consent forms back, and then we're only able to vaccinate the kids who have consent forms returned from their parent or guardian. So it'll be interesting to see this week as we conduct with the school districts, the school-based clinics that we're putting on this week, how many kids actually are there with the signed consent forms and that we're able to vaccinate, so that we'll know we're sort of don't have enough for the clinics scheduled for next week yet, and we're not exactly sure when the FedEx guy is going to show up with more vaccines. So I think that's the situation the counties all throughout California are in. There were some optimistic projections a couple months ago about when we could expect to receive the numbers of vaccine that we've ordered, and the manufacturers have been unable to keep up with those optimistic projections, and counties are all clamoring, waiting for the State Department of Public Health, you know, to actually not the State Department of Public Health, but wait for the orders to be filled and the vaccine to show up. So Wednesday's a county holiday. I wasn't at the ops meeting this morning, but I think somebody drew the short straw to be at work on Wednesday in case the delivery arrives. So the emphasis right now is on those school-based clinics. We have been working with pediatricians and other direct providers, but they made their orders directly to the state and are getting their deliveries directly as well. So we do have a little bit in public health departments, and we're getting the word out for the highest risk populations. Haven't scheduled any clinics that I'm aware of, you know, in terms of a specific date that would be widely publicized for a public health department-based clinic. Emphasis is on the schools. I think I heard we're hoping to maybe do two a day. Is that right? Two schools a day. There's 60 schools in the queue. Any questions about that? Yes.
What grades? All grades?
K through 6, I think, are those that we're emphasizing initially.
Okay. And how many doses do you have, and how many do you need?
I don't know.
Don't know.
I think we got 3,500.
And are these injections, or is this nasal?
It's a mix.
A mix?
Yes.
So some of each?
Yes.
And is it the same thing all over the country, or is California worse than other states?
You mean in terms of
needed doses and doses
received?
No,
I think it's pretty much the same everywhere.
Okay.
California, I think initially we were expecting 6.5 million doses, and I'm not exactly sure. I mean, you know, a third of those go to Los Angeles, but not exactly sure where we are. I think we were at about 40% of the doses that we had ordered, 42 or something like that. Some counties were higher, others were lower. There was a lot of anxiety amongst the counties about the people who got more than, I mean, you know, parity is always an issue among counties.
So you're flipping a coin, or you start alphabetical, or which schools go first?
I'm not sure exactly how we've been working with the County Office of Ed and the school districts for weeks, and how we queued them up, the order in which we queued them up, I'm not sure how we made that determination. It probably had something to do with the level of interest or the level of energy that individual school sites were able to put into who was going to be ready first.
Thank you.
Mr. Garina?
A corollary is, how are we doing with seasonal flu vaccine? I understand that there's a shortage, and do you know if that's going to be an issue?
We didn't have as much as it turns out we needed. I do not believe that we have any assurance that we will get, that the county will get a sufficient supply that would allow us to develop a plan for, you know, inviting either employees or other target populations back. We are suggesting that folks stay in touch. There's a website, and I don't have it memorized. I think we've mentioned it before, findafluShot.org or something like that, that we encourage people to use and to stay in touch with their provider. And I tell my mom to keep calling her doc to see if, you know, when one will be available. So.
Commissioner Samusis? Sorry, I'm going to knock everything over. Is there any studies on the efficacy of the inhaled as opposed to the injected vaccine?
I don't know if there are any studies. I doubt
information.
That there, yeah, I don't know that there would have been time to have any data on the relative efficacy of one type versus the other. So that's a good question. I have no idea.
Related somewhat to that, in terms of the amount of time it takes between the vaccination and the level of immunity.
You know, you're asking me all these doctor questions.
Sorry, you're it.
She's not here.
There's a doctor in the audience. Yeah.
Hey, doctor.
Maybe he knows.
Is it 2 weeks?
Come up to the microphone.
Let's just put him on the spot right
now. Either one of them will.
We want to give them.
Is there a doctor in the house?
Oh, sure. My name is Dr. Scott Bishop. I'm the medical director of the Sierra Vista Emergency Department. So the answer to your question is no one knows. So I got up all this way to tell you that, right?
I could have said that, yeah.
So because it's such a novel strain, nobody knows the answer for sure. But we have an expectation of weeks. And, you know, the big concern is now that we're seeing a big uptick in the number of cases, are we behind the eight ball? Probably, but my best guess is that with the information and the data that we have, that it'll still save... I'll spare a lot of people from getting the H1N1 for those who are vaccinated.
One other question. I guess it would be more hypothetical. Have we ever had a flu vaccination that was inhaled as opposed to injected?
Yes.
And is there any knowledge about efficacy in terms of that?
Yeah, so for seasonal flu virus, yes. So the inhaled virus is typically a live virus versus the immunization that's a shot, which is a dead virus. And so they typically have comparable efficacies. They're comparably equal.
Does one get on board faster than the other?
I actually don't know the answer to that as an emergency room physician, but my best guess is that's probably the case. I think the big difference is between the two is just the palatability for children, right? So who wants a shot?
Thank you.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Thanks very much. Yeah. Always happy when that happens. Any other questions on that topic? As I mentioned, the other thing I wanted to touch on, you will recall from previous commission meetings, and for those of you who followed along with what had occurred when we took the our agreement with CHC back to the Board of Supervisors in August to get them to approve it, there was some anxiety, some concern, certainly interest in the more detailed level of understanding of the consequences of the reductions that had been, I want to say suggested, but that we thought would be unavoidable with the level of reduction in the county's grant. And those were specifically related to having to let some of the capacity that we had maintained for specialty care referral by CHC retaining a neurologist or having a relationship with a group of orthopedic specialists or a cardiologist, and that we actually obligated them by our contract for a part of the grant to maintain that capacity, of course, specifically for CMSP and unsponsored persons as opposed to individuals with Medi-Cal or Medicare or some other third-party payer source. Since the board directed us to work together to come up with a more detailed characterization of what those impacts might be, I have submitted to CHC management an amendment to the agreement that was just executed that would compensate them an increase of $200,000, which would come from the $700,000 list, which isn't $700,000 anymore, but you recall some of the things that we had already committed funds to from that list, to sustain the same capacity that they had been maintaining for neurology, orthopedic care, and cardiology. That wasn't all of the specialty services that were on the discussion list, but it's those that we felt would be the most problematic if we had not been able to maintain them through an increase in the grant to CHC. I haven't heard back from them with an official or unofficial response, for that matter, to our proposal. I have a meeting with them. I'm not looking at my calendar. I'm not sure if it's this week or early next week, but hopefully that will be acceptable to them. We can get an amendment to the contract to the board fairly quickly, last meeting in November or the first meeting in December. That will get us through this fiscal year as it relates to those issues, specialty care access for CMSP and unsponsored patients, at least for those three specialties. I think I mentioned at the meeting last month that we don't expect the upcoming 2010-11 fiscal year to be any easier. And so that issue and other issues will be back on the table as we develop, you know, a list of the possible service level reductions that the health agency would face, and develop detailed information about the consequences of those for the board's consideration in the spring as we look at the 2010-11 budget. But it would, it is consistent with the basic position that the commission has taken, that we should do everything we can with those extra excess salary and benefit appropriations to use them to sustain the provision of direct services. So, again, we don't have an agreement with them yet, but we have given them a proposal, and that's a summary of the contents of the proposal. Any questions about that?
Thank you for that bit of good news.
Okay.
Is the board anticipating saving any of that excess money, or are they not obligated to spend it all in one fiscal year as opposed, say, to the next fiscal year?
You're talking about the $700,000? We expect to spend it. The health agency expects to spend it in the current fiscal year.
More so on direct patient services? Is that?
Well, as much as we can, yes. That's what I've indicated all along. We did, how much did we put into the Tascadero project ultimately? 116. The first 100 was to augment the CHC contract for the fact that we were already into the fiscal year and debating, you know, there was a delay in their ability to even make the reductions that we might have been willing to allow them to make. There was $35,000 from the $700,000 that was a cost shift to our CMSP program, having to do with first visits, the cost of the first visit that they would refer to specialists outside of the short list of specialty care providers that they maintained. You'll recall, I don't have the list in front of me, but you'll recall there were other things. We lost some revenue in animal services. We had to make that up or change our policies pertaining to the, you know, how long we'd hold an animal, the adoptable animal, before we might be forced to euthanize it. We're not going to change that. We just lost $125,000 of what had been state money. So those revenue shortfalls are the kinds of things that's typically the first thing you do, is if all of a sudden you found out that you lost $80,000 of state money that was covering fixed costs in some of your categorical programs, and you either apply something like salary savings to that revenue shortfall to sustain the services that you already are planning on providing, or you take further cuts. So you sort of have to cover those holes before you can talk about restoring cuts that you had already made.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
I have something new for you.
Okay.
This was something that came through my emails, and it's an Operation Medicine Cabinet, which is Santa Barbara County's collaboration between their sheriff's department and, of all places, their public works. Thought it would have been their public health. But they were doing collection dates on expired and unused medications. Mm. And I'll give you this, and just wondered, you know, is there some kind of collaboration that we might pull together in this county? And with our speakers tonight, I think that we find that medications are a huge issue for people with overdoses. And if there was some way that we, I know we've looked at it, and Chairman Commissioner Guernas brought some things to us, but I really think that that could be a unique collaboration in our county to help not only with the drug problem, but...
Okay, well, just looking at it quickly, the sheriff's office is involved because kids get their hands on unused pharmaceuticals.
Right.
The public works is involved because if it gets flushed down the toilet, it ends up in the water systems.
The sheriff department is actually involved with it because of controlled substances. So they're the only ones that can get controlled substances, and that's what's holding up the whole process of returning medications. Is that there's federal laws that say you can't, pharmacists can't even accept it. So it's got to be law enforcement, and on the public works, it's the hazardous or hazardous substances.
Yeah.
So it's like matching the police with the dump, and that's why they can do that. And I mean, this is a good start. It's unfortunately, it's just one-shot deal.
I see generous support from cities of blah, blah, blah. So we can look into how they are managing to finance this.
What are they doing with it after they pick it up, Ed?
Well, they have to send it off to a designated incineration.
Incineration.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's got to be, it's got to be within the law. But there's plenty of those around, actually. But they have to pay for it.
Might be worth getting the hospitals involved.
I just, as long as we brought something else up, I wanted to ask you if you found any more space for the La Clinica de Tolosa in Paso Robles yet.
No.
No. That was a quick answer.
Yeah, sorry.
Look, keep looking.
Okay.
Any other questions of Jeff? Is that your report tonight?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Sue and Dr. Bishop, welcome. We've heard a lot about your presentation, so we're ready.
Sue, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Good evening. I'm Sue Fortier. I'm a clinical nurse specialist in emergency and trauma nursing, and I'm the trauma program manager at Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center. So thank you for inviting me to speak this evening.
Go ahead, please.
So we're here to talk about really the impact of that we see on alcohol use and abuse in our community on the emergency department and the health of our patients. Scott was going to start off with what exactly we see.
Sure. So I guess that you had heard that we had visited the Drug and Alcohol Services meeting, what was that, maybe a week or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just had a nice conversation with the folks there. We do alcohol abuse, alcohol intoxication, and alcohol and drug-related emergencies really well, and we know it like the back of our hand. What I don't know necessarily is what questions you folks have or what you would like to know from us. So if it's appropriate, I'd like to try and make my time as much as possible interactive and have you ask a lot of questions, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. That would be more rewarding for me. We are ground zero for a lot of acute alcohol intoxication and alcohol-related problems. And by we, I mean the emergency departments, all four of them in the county, of course. I've worked in various and sundry emergency departments in different counties, and the population that we see here isn't, or doesn't seem to be anecdotally significantly different than what I see in, say, L.A. County or other counties in which I've worked. We have quite a few alcohol-related visits. I asked our staff to try and come up with some numbers for you so I can give you an idea of what one of the four hospitals sees. And it turns out, and Sue can talk a little bit about this, but it's quite difficult. We just don't have at the moment. We don't have the resources. I wish I was able to tell you this is how many visits we've seen. And I don't have that information for you. What I can tell you is that everywhere I've ever worked, and this is the Sierra Vista is no different, upwards of 40 to 50% of all of our traumatic injuries, so not heart attacks or strokes, but car accidents, falls, have alcohol or some substance involved with them. Upwards of and greater than 50% of all of our domestic violence that we see that comes through, so injuries related to that, have alcohol or substance related to them. On any given night in our facility, probably particularly because we're the closest facility to our Cal State University, we'll see between 4 and 10, roughly, depending on the night of the week, acute alcohol intoxication, so typically a bimodal distribution, so we'll see, you know, the 16-ish to 23-ish to 25-ish. Mm-hmm. We'll probably see 4 to 6 patients that are so intoxicated they are unconscious, and we'll see that typically almost every night of the week, more so on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, somewhat on Sundays. The second distribution that we see tends to be a slightly older population, perhaps best characterized as chronic alcohol users, we see them for more of the chronic problems that brings. Sure, they'll come in intoxicated, but often they have liver failure, low blood counts, they've fallen and bled into the brain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there is no shortage of I was trained at the University of California, Los Angeles, worked in a county hospital, saw lots and lots of patients and trained how to care for these folks, and there's no shortage of these patients in my emergency department, I have not forgotten how to take care of them subsequently. I mean, we do that. We are experts. Sue, do you want to take it from there, please?
Sure. One, I would add that certainly being under the influence makes it more difficult for us to do our job, both as physicians and nurses. You know, when patients come in and are coherent, which is the majority of people who are injured, except for our head-injured individuals, they're able to actually assist us in their assessment, what's going on with them. We're able to actually focus our assessment where it's appropriate. And when you're intoxicated or under the influence, I just think that adds to the difficulty of us being able to discover what's wrong with the individual, and it also lengthens the person's stay and makes the whole, you know, all the testing more involved and more expensive for the individual and for healthcare in general. So that's just another impact that we don't often think about, but certainly comes to our minds on a daily basis.
If I can interrupt.
Sure.
Specifically, what we mean by that, so we're a 10 to an 11-bed emergency department. Mm-hmm. On Halloween, which is probably a dramatic example, mm-hmm. at 3:30 in the morning, 7 of our 10 beds were filled with acutely intoxicated, comatose or near comatose patients. If there was, for instance, other emergencies at that time that came in, what happens when we fill all the beds is people have to wait in the waiting room. And so it's not infrequent for these typically the rule that we have for patient safety is, if you can walk when you're sober, you have to walk out of our emergency department. You have to be coherent, and you have to be able to tolerate fluids or eating. And the typical length of stay for our acutely intoxicated patient, probably, again, I apologize, I don't have specific data, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's on the order of 6 to 8 to 10 hours in an emergency department bed, taking up a bed that you or your family member may need if they're acutely ill.
Yeah, so really does have an impact on all of us. And, you know, not that any age group is immune to injury, nor really immune to, after you hit adolescence, immune to alcohol use and injury. But clearly we have an issue with our 18 to 23-year-old college age, late high school, and early adolescent group. And because that's the demographic that we see most frequently, and even though our data collection methods are rather crude and not very developed as of yet, it certainly is an area of concern or an age group of concern for us, and for several reasons. One is that adolescents are really vulnerable to alcohol use for many reasons. One, that they don't have a lot of experience with alcohol. They often lack, you know, our college students who have been, you know, come from good homes, good areas, and they get here and they suddenly are without parental support and supervision, which is just part of growing up, but also puts them at risk to developing unhealthy behaviors. And some of the unhealthy behaviors and patterns of drinking that we see in early adolescence Some of those people can go on and develop lifelong problems with alcohol and patterns of abuse. And that really sets them up for a lifetime of increased risk of mortality and morbidity, and related from injury and just from the alcohol use itself. So it is certainly an area where we feel, as healthcare providers, that we really want to be able to intervene. We, in the emergency department, I think we have the opportunity to care for a subset of patients that, and people that abuse alcohol that other community members don't see. You know, law enforcement sees a portion of persons that use alcohol or abuse alcohol. Our school systems see some of it. Our colleges see some. But that's just, we really need to look at all the different fractions. And I think data that we collect or contribute in the ER could really help us get a bigger or a better picture on what's actually happening in our community. And we have, the other opportunity we have as emergency department providers is we have the opportunity to really confront people about their drinking. So when you come in the emergency department and you are there because of your drinking, we actually can say, you know, bring it to your attention. You know, do you realize that, you know, drinking six drinks and then getting in your car was probably not a good idea? And perhaps your use of alcohol is related to the fact that you were in an accident, regardless of whether law enforcement is involved or not. And same thing with kids, you know, getting on your bicycle after you've had 21 shots and deciding to drive downtown, not such a good idea. So we really have a unique opportunity to kind of put a connection between alcohol use and injury in our patients. And our focus going forward, because Sierra Vista currently treats a lot of injured patients in the community, and as we are part of the developing trauma system here in San Luis Obispo County, and so our focus really is going to be looking at what types of patients are injured, getting better data on those injuries, and looking at the incidence of alcohol and other substance use as it relates to those injuries. Part of the proposed trauma plan that we have, the San Luis Obispo Trauma System Committee has put forward, is that there will be a purchase and exploration of a trauma registry for next year. And in that trauma registry, we'll have a much better ability to collect data and to look at each and every one of those patients for the incidence of alcohol or other substance use within those injuries. So from that data, next year we wouldn't be standing here in front of you unable to produce what our exact incidence and of alcohol and injury in our community is. So I hope we would have better data for you next year. And that's about what I came to say, I think. Any questions?
Commissioner Shumisa.
Hi, that's me.
Sorry.
Thanks for the presentation. And this is a question for either of you. I understand that you don't have very sophisticated data collection, but do you have a feel for, say, the impact of the education that you give to these patients? Do you see repeat offenders? Do you have
Well, it's something that, you know, as a, we don't have or haven't had up to this point an opportunity to screen or intervene on all patients. Certainly, emergency departments are tied because of time issues, overcrowding issues, numerous issues. But going forward, as we move forward in our trauma center development, that'll be a program that we're looking to institute on all patients that come into the emergency department and formalize some of the, formalize that program quite a bit.
There's an extensive body of literature on what you're asking. You know, how important is an intervention in the emergency department setting? And I wish I could tell you that it was fantastic, but unfortunately it's not. Now, we walk a really fine line. I never want to be in a position where I'm making a patient feel like the next time they come in, they're going to hear a lecture from me. After all, my job is to make sure that they're going to be okay and safe. And that really goes for a lot of things. So it's a really careful calibration of that discussion that you have with somebody and talking about, hey, you know what, I care about you. I want you to be well. If, you know, if alcohol is a problem for you, let's talk about what the resources are and not cross the line where I'm lecturing and where I'm making them uncomfortable so that the next time they get into a medical emergency, they're not willing to come and be seen. So it's a real challenge at that point. But we do our best. I think where we'll get the most bang for the buck is to make the referrals and have that conversation subsequent to the initial traumatic event.
I agree. Dr. Reina?
I thank you for the presentation. I know you don't have the stats, but do you have a gut feeling specifically about our students in our university over time? Are you seeing a worse problem? Is it getting worse?
I've been collecting data now for the last 18 months. Formally, as I'm new in my role, 18 months ago. And so I've only been collecting data for that period of time, and I wouldn't say that the problem's getting any worse. I wouldn't say that we're unique. I've worked in, like Scott, I've worked in several college area towns. I worked at University of New Hampshire right at the ground zero of a major university there, and I've worked across the country. So I wouldn't say that we're unique, but I'd say that that's where we have our opportunity to be. You know, if we're going to put money toward injury prevention and put money toward making some strides against, you know, alcohol abuse in our community, I would say that is where, that's hands down where we see the most number of patients who abuse alcohol. Would you disagree with me, Dr. Bishop?
That's a good question, and I think what you're asking, correct me if I'm wrong, is are we getting the sense of the gut feeling that there's more inappropriate drinking at Cal Poly or at the university setting? By inappropriate, I mean not two drinks. I mean, drinking to become unconscious. Is your question? Do we feel like there's more of that? Because it's.
I'm concerned about the school and the impact of it. But from what I hear, our university has taken over. Chico State is the party school of the state, and you know we're parents are scared when they hear stuff like that.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, are you working at all with the administration of the school? Are you giving them any data?
Yeah, we just spent about 3 hours at Cal Poly's. There was an event for all of their fraternity members that Sue and I attended and had a discussion about Mr. Starkey and his death and talked to them about some of the perils along with Deb Linden and some of the other members and leaders in the community. Interestingly, and right or wrong, I don't know the answer, but the Cal Poly is working really hard to encourage the students to seek emergency care if their fellow student or friend is passed out or having trouble. So an increase in our census may not necessarily represent an increase in the census of drinking, and so may not necessarily be the best place for data collection at that point. You know, we see a modicum of patients who come in. They're intoxicated, but they're awake, alert, talking, and they don't spend any time in the emergency department. They can go home. So the real trouble begins when you're talking about patients who are so drunk that they cannot care for themselves. They can't walk. They can't talk. They will inhale their vomit. If they vomit, don't mean to be crude, but, I mean, they will aspirate and die. And so those are our problem patients.
Yeah.
We're going to try and minimize those.
Dr. Craven?
How quickly for an unconscious patient with alcohol on his breath can you get an alcohol blood level?
I'm glad you asked the question. You can. In general, it's not helpful, and let me quickly explain why. An alcohol level is, of course, a level of the blood in it, but it does not at all predict intoxication.
Right.
So somebody who is naive, who has never had a drink in their life, and they go out and have 3 glasses of wine, for example, may be profoundly intoxicated. Conversely, somebody who is a chronic alcoholic may drink 12 drinks a day, go out and have 3 drinks, have the same blood alcohol level, and be withdrawing from alcohol. So the blood alcohol level is almost clinically useless. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but at least it lets you rule out something else.
intoxicated. That have to abuse our at screen. Really deep. But
question. We
students that persons.
So acutely out. And is that not in that have level. Substance.
And I'm hearing before we thank you.
How does that
goes in the county. On the order. Demonstrates it. I only know what.
Wasn't there...
decided then.
connection with. Call 911. It happens to opposite something. In the sand.
exhausted. Let's everybody. For an update. Of the emergency. On different ways.
There.